This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Sisters and brothers, fathers and mothers, have you heard the word on the street? From Beijing to New York City, it's a number, it's the answer, it's 350.
This is Radio EcoShock on the triple threat: peak oil, climate change, and the crumbling economy. How will you respond? Hear indie journalist Kurt Cobb ask and answer some of the embarrassing questions. We start out with collapse and try to recover, just like everybody else. Our second guest, Carolyn Baker, has already moved into post-peak reality. Her books, her blog, her seminars help people prepare, physically and psychologically, living in the slump and coming out whole. We'll round up with the big cover-up in the North. Canada's oil patch prime minister appoints climate deniers to key research boards, slashes research, and muzzles top scientists. Shades of George Bush. How they keep Canadians and the rest of the world in the dark. That is Graham Saul of Climate Action Network, interviewed by Stephen Leahy. All to 350 tunes. Let's go.
Human beings with eyes that see and ears that come to understand what's long been clear. There's too much carbon in our atmosphere.
Friends, our developing predicament is so strange, so new, we hardly know what to think. Forget about answers. What are the right questions to ask? Time after time, Kurt Cobb gets those questions ahead of the curve. Kurt is an independent writer on energy and the environment. Find his features on Energy Bulletin or the Oil Drum and more. Kurt is a founding member of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA. His work is published in Europe as well. Kurt Cobb, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here, Alex.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, too. I've been running a series of interviews about collapse. Scientist Tim Garrett told us about a massive economic breakdown. That might be the only way to save the climate. That was a few weeks ago. And we heard from Keith Farnish in the UK and both Dmitry Orlov and John Michael Greer in the USA. Well, last week, we used a gentle definition of collapse from Dennis Meadows. He said, collapse is a process where things go down out of control, end quote. How do you define collapse?
I'm inclined to use Joseph Tainter's idea of collapse. And Tainter wrote a book in the late 80s called The Collapse of Complex Societies. And he went back and looked at various cultures and civilizations in the past and tried to find commonalities in their collapse. And the thing that he focused on is complexity. So I'm inclined to think about that as well. And so a collapse is not everybody dies, everything's over. A collapse, in his view, is you move from a higher form of complexity to a lower form of complexity. You're simplifying your society, and that this happens because of many variables, one of which would be resource exhaustion or climate change.
Although I have read in one of your pieces a definition that also included an increase in the death rate or something along those lines. Can you tell me about that?
Well, in that piece, I was thinking about what would be a clear marker of decline, of collapse. Because, you know, you can say, well, the collapse has begun because any number of factors, the financial collapse, the leveling of yields in food crops, not so much yields as per capita grain supplies, have not really been growing in the last 20 years. So you could use any index you want. And I wanted to use one that I thought was pretty much indisputable. If you have death rates rising and birth rates are staying steady or falling, then you're going to get a decline in population over time. And it's pretty clear that when that happens, a lot of very big, important, and sometimes catastrophic changes are going to take place in your society. So I was just using that as a marker because we do have some place in the world today where that's happening, and it's Russia. They avoided a decline this year, but they've had 18 years of decline prior to this. And so although Russia doesn't appear to be in terrible shape, something happened in 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, that was a simplifying event that has created these terrible consequences for the people of Russia, one of which is the collapse of their public health system. So there's a lot of different facets of collapse. You can have a collapse of resources. You can have a collapse that's related to climate change. You can have a collapse that's related to the destruction of certain administrative processes like public health. There's lots of ways that can happen. So that's why I use that example.
Well, the AIDS deaths in Russia and the Ukraine are frightening, and some Americans think that's all in the past. But in a recent news article, I just read that the leading cause of death for African-American women aged 25 to 34 is HIV/AIDS. It's at epidemic levels in the nation's capital. Few of those people have health care. Is it possible Americans could also experience a climbing death rate as the economy deteriorates?
I think that that's likely, and it may not come directly out of the decline of the healthcare system as we know it. It's probably going to come indirectly through a decline in income and employment among the poorest people in the nation and among people who are currently middle class but lose their jobs and fall into the ranks of the impoverished. That means that their diets are not going to be as good. And that is always something that precedes health problems. If you can't get a good diet, then you're likely to be sick more often. You're likely to have your health decline. So I think that that's an area that we're going to see some problems in health rise. There is, of course, epidemic disease. And to the extent that the federal government and the state governments and local governments can't fund public health measures to contain diseases like AIDS, we're going to see rising infection rates and deaths.
And we're hearing about hospitals closing in Florida just due to economic difficulties.
Right. Well, and hospitals, keep in mind, are the place of last resort for the population that is uninsured. So to the extent that they can't get medical care from hospitals, this is charity care now that's financed by you and me through our health insurance premiums and also through taxation. The government provides some money to hospitals for charity care. If they can't get that care, then where do they go? I mean, they don't have regular doctors. They don't have insurance. So I think this is going to be a real problem as these facilities become few and far between.
Do you think that the U.S. economy, and I guess we could include Great Britain as well, do you think that we are approaching a collapse?
I think that we won't experience collapse as a sort of one-off event. And let me give you an example. We've had this near financial collapse in 2008 and early 2009. Now, the system is still with us. The financial system that essentially brought about that collapse is still with us. And yet, it's in the air that we can't maintain that system. We can't have this system of high concentration of banking power in a few large banks because when they screw up, the whole system can go down. So there's already a move afoot to break up those banks, limit their growth, to regulate them more. And in some ways, when you say we want to break things up, that means you want to reduce their complexity and you want to decentralize. And this is the heart of collapse. I mean, it's moving from high complexity to lower complexity. And I think that we're already on that path. Now, if we were to have some catastrophic economic failure in the future, like the Great Depression, what happened there was suddenly, world trade shut down. And this is the thing that really aggravated the Great Depression, is that people who had formerly relied on trade for their livelihoods simply didn't have a livelihood anymore. And we had systems of trading that, you know, they're going to send us sugar beets and we're going to send them machinery. Well, if that's not happening, where are you going to get your sugar beets? That kind of collapse could be very, very painful, and we'd know it. So I think there's going to be two sort of collapse-type events that occur over time. One will be sort of gradual. We choose to make things less complex because we think that's the right way to go, and others will involuntarily will be forced back on our own resources and a simpler system.
I think one of the things that brings it to my mind is when I walk through my local mall, there are a lot of shops that are empty now. Things seem to just sort of disappear. Newspapers disappear, or a car company you've had all your life disappears. It's that things going away that surprises us and reminds us that everything isn't going well.
A society is essentially a very complex ecosystem. And if you think of a society as an ecosystem, there are niches, occupational niches and business niches. And as that society changes, some of those niches disappear. And I think that's what you're seeing, is we've had this tremendous jolt in 2008, early 2009 with the financial collapse. And now we're seeing the ripples of that. And we're simplifying our society. Not every niche is going to survive. Now, what does that mean? That means a lot of people are going to be unemployed. A lot of businesses are going to go bust. And that's a terrible and painful thing. But it's what's happening as a result of this simplifying process, which is, I think, already underway. I don't think that we're, you know, I may have to eat my words in a few years. I don't think we're going to go back to the global economy that we saw in the last decade. I think that we're going to go towards something else, and it's going to be less complex.
So people who are joining the simplicity movement or trying to straighten out their own expectations downward may just be responding in a human way to this larger problem.
Sure. I think that human beings, even if they don't intellectually understand all that's going on in this very complex world, and who of us really does understand the whole thing? That's part of the problem. We don't understand exactly how these systems work, and so when they break down, we don't know how to fix them. But I think there is this intuitive, instinctive sense that one needs to pull back, simplify, change one's life, and a lot of people have been doing that for a long time. I mean, one example that I think is very prominent now is the local food movement, which is really just everywhere. People have known for a while now that we need to do something about our food system, and I think they're doing something very sensible, which is, well, let's make it simpler. Let's make it local. Let's grow some of our own food. Let's have community gardens. And that's a good development. In other ways, we're hanging on to systems that don't work. You know, worldwide car companies. I'm not sure that's the future of civilization, is more automobiles. And yet we've tried here in the United States to revive the U.S. auto industry. I think we could have used that money for better purposes, although, of course, if we had done that, a lot of people would be out of work that aren't today. Of course, eventually, I think they will be. So we're just holding back the flood, and we'll just have a worse flood when the whole thing comes apart. That is the whole sort of what James Howard Kunstler calls the happy motoring culture comes apart.
Well, we'll get to that in just a sec. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Kurt Cobb. Among other things, he's a columnist for the Paris-based science news site Citizen. Kurt, some of us have read The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler or The Long Descent by last week's guest John Michael Greer. You say collapse may not be a smooth downward slope on a graph. It might be ragged and rough. Can you tell us a bit more?
What would be the next crisis and the next crisis? I mean, if you look at the various areas where we have too much pressure on resources, you can predict that we're going to have an energy crisis again at some point. You can predict that we're going to have food shortages again at some point, just like we did in 2008. Whether those shortages are going to be enough to bring the system down, in other words, force it to become less complex, we have to wait and see. But I tend to think that the crises we're going to see in the next couple, three decades are going to be periodic. We'll have a crisis, then we will try to adapt to the conditions that result from the crisis, or we'll try to fix it, and then we'll stabilize for a while, just like we have now. And then we'll face another crisis, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years out. And we will successively try to address these crises, I think, partly not understanding that they're part of a greater wave of change, which is forcing us to become simpler in the way that we do things. If we understood that today, I think we could make smarter decisions. But there are vested interests which want to keep us where we are.
And one of those vested interests is each one of us, though, in a way. We want our normal lives to go on with commuters and shopping and paying our mortgage. James Howard Kunstler, in his latest blog entry, remarked on that, how for those of us who have looked at these very daunting problems, it seems surreal that the normal parade should just keep on going. How do you feel about that?
I think there are fewer people who want it to keep going. I think there are people who are questioning whether that system is going to work for them. But consider that they have no alternative right now. I mean, right now, those of us who are aware of the resource constraints facing human civilization, aware of the climate problems facing civilization, aware of the complexity issues facing civilization, we can't step out of human civilization and say, well, we're going to do things all differently over here in my corner of the planet, because we are all connected to those systems that are currently being used by everyone, that are currently dominant, the global trading system. If I want something here where I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan, I can go to the store and try and find it, and sometimes I can't find it, and I'll have to go to the Internet. Okay, well, this is the worldwide global logistics system, and even most of the stores that are here in my town, they rely on that logistics system. Now, if I go to my local food co-op, I can get some locally grown food because it's available and they've made an attempt to provide it to me. So there are systems that are growing up to replace this global logistical system that we've created, but they are not sufficient to all our needs. I think this is the difficulty that people face when they want to make this transition to a less complex life, a less complex society, is that we have to rebuild all those systems for a more localized existence, and they're not there yet.
I know you have a history in the peak oil movement. Could you tell us, for those few who don't know, how energy supplies could drive us toward a collapse of our present system?
If you think about everything we use every day, everything we do every day, if you have an automobile, even if you ride the bus or you ride the train, you go shopping, get your food, you go to work, and where you work, all the machines are powered by, you say, oh, electricity, but that electricity, almost all of it comes from the burning of fossil fuels. Now, all of those things are going to be affected as oil supplies decline, as natural gas supplies become tighter. Maybe even coal isn't going to be available to us in the quantities that we think it is in the next decade or two. So we can't really disengage ourselves from that system. Let me put it this way. If the energy inputs into all those systems that I discussed is suddenly declining or gone one day, let's say there's a crisis and oil imports are cut off, we'll very quickly be put back on our own resources trying to figure out, okay, how can I get food now that the trucking industry is in crisis and can't ship as much to my locale, now that the transportation infrastructure is in crisis because there's not enough fuel, how do I get to work? We have to start very quickly working out how we're going to do things without those fuel supplies. And that's what I mean by, you know, that's a sudden crisis that would force us to simplify the way we do things. Not a pleasant one, and not one that we could prepare for gradually.
But you and I both know it's not just all about energy. I mean, what about people's belief in the system? That's something that Orlov brings up, that in the Soviet Union, there just came a period where people didn't believe in the whole thing anymore, and that's when it collapsed. What do you say about that?
I'm not sure I would put it that way. I myself was studying in the Soviet Union in 1978. And there were a lot of people that I met during that period that didn't believe in the system then. I think, and by believe in the system, I mean they realized the kind of system they lived under. They realized the kind of censorship they lived with. They realized the kind of regimentation that was imposed on them. And they didn't particularly like it, but they didn't see any way around it or out of it. I think that's the key thing. Is when you see a way out of it, and enough people see a way out of it, then things move. And I think that's what's happening in a way here in the United States, and probably to a certain extent in Canada, is people are seeing a way around, for example, the global food system. They're saying, I can grow some of my own. I can have a community garden. I can buy from a local farmer. So that, to me, is the key element. When you see the opening, that's when this kind of change, this kind of phase change in society can occur.
I think that's a good point. Well, along those lines, suppose you had two teenage children, or, you know, 14 or 15. Would you try and steer them into college or a technical trade, or what would you advise them?
I haven't had to think about this because I don't have any children, but I think I would tell them to go to college, but also be thinking about starting something themselves, thinking in an entrepreneurial way. And here I'm not thinking about the normal way in which we think about entrepreneurs, which is they have some internet startup and then eventually get an IPO and get rich. That's not what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about, rather than have some complex global organization, whether a large corporation or a large nonprofit that's worldwide, determine your future. Try to figure out how you can create something that's going to function in a lower complexity environment that can provide you with a livelihood and can also provide something of value to the people in your community in that environment. Now, that's not a recipe for getting rich. It's a recipe for surviving and having good relations with your neighbors and having something to do in a society where things are on the move toward simplification. I've been thinking about this myself. I mean, what exactly are the jobs that are going to be available 10 years from now or 20 years from now? It's hard to know if this simplification process continues. You can make some guesses that more people will be engaged in growing food. More people will be providing some kind of craft work. They'll be creating objects that we need in daily life. More people will be involved in repairing things and trying to make them last longer. Those are some guesses. But it's not always obvious, one, what will be available in the way of work, and two, how it will be organized. So I think the people who figure this out first are going to become very important to their communities. They're going to say, oh, this person understands what needs to be done now. So I think that would point the way to a successful life. Not the kind of successful life that we define today as making lots of money, but a successful life in contributing to your community, finding something that you love, being able to do it within the confines or within the context of a rapidly changing society.
Our guest has been Kurt Cobb. You will find his stimulating work all over the net at sites like Energy Bulletin, The Oil Drum, and more. His blog is at resourceinsights.blogspot.com. Thank you, Kurt.
Thanks for having me.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We'll hear more from Kurt Cobb next week on Radio EcoShock. Meanwhile, I want you to hear just a sample from the remarkable end-of-career conversion by Professor David Goodstein. He's the American physicist, until recently the vice provost of California Institute of Technology. Out of the blue, in 2004, Goodstein produced the seminal book, Out of Gas, The End of the Age of Oil. Here are just a couple of sample clips of David Goodstein recorded for the film Crude Awakening, The Oil Crash, from Lava Pictures. Get your taste at oilcrashmovie.com or on YouTube.
Everything we read in the newspapers today suggests, at least to me, that the worldwide distribution and production and distribution system for oil is stretched to the breaking point. That the Saudis have promised to increase their production by a million barrels a day. Nobody knows whether they're capable of doing that, and even that is only 1% of the worldwide oil flow. It's really very small. That could be a symptom of being close to this legendary peak that we keep hearing about. In the meantime, there are 1.3 billion people in China. Something like a third of them already have driver's licenses, and most urban Chinese believe that they will own a car within 5 years. It's the fastest growing automobile market on Earth. And so the demand for oil and for gasoline in China is really going to take off in the near future. The price of oil will shoot up, and that will make other hydrocarbons economically competitive. In fact, the oil sands of Alberta are already competitive. They are being mined. But these are not liquid deposits of oil. These are solid deposits. You have to mine 2 tons of ore to extract 1 barrel of a fuel called bitumen. And the bitumen is not rich enough to distill into gasoline, so they have to add hydrogen to it. And so some of the biggest plants in the world for obtaining hydrogen from natural gas, methane, have been built in Alberta. And so your methane, after all, is a fossil fuel. So you're burning fossil fuel to make fossil fuel. And that will become increasingly true as you go down the list of possible hydrocarbons that can replace the oil. In doing that, we're not only using up the legacy that the planet took hundreds of millions of years to gather for us, we're also putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and endangering the future of the climate of the planet. I think we could solve this problem if we tried, but we're not trying, and that's why I try so hard to get the message out. You can ignore me if you like and wait for the crisis to come, and maybe it won't come for your lifetime. I can pretty well guarantee that it will come in your grandchildren's lifetime. So if you care about that, then you should be doing something about it.
That was Caltech physicist David Goodstein, filmed for Crude Awakening. Time to move on.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you feeling torn? Part of us wants normal life to continue, yet inside we know it's tearing Earth's life apart. Our whole system seems to be built on dwindling fossil energy, pollution, economic bubbles, maybe fraud. Now, what are we going to do? Well, looking for answers, we find Carolyn Baker. She's been a psychotherapist and adjunct professor of psychology and history. Carolyn has been searching ahead since at least the 1990s. Her latest book is Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. From Boulder, Colorado, Carolyn, it's a treat to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
What moved you from academia to the study of social breakdown and rejuvenation?
Well, it was a real easy transition because during my time as an adjunct professor of history, I increasingly began to look at where Western civilization was going, is going, and it was very clear to me that we were confronting a triple crisis, a convergence of crises between energy depletion, environmental devastation, and economic meltdown. And other issues in there as well that are related to all three. So it was quite a natural transition because the one fed into the other.
And I was struck by an article you posted in April of last year titled Economic Recovery, No Thank You. Why would you say that?
Well, because our economic model in Western civilization is based on unlimited growth. And that is, by definition, unsustainable. So what we've come up against in this unlimited growth model is a brick wall, which is because of economic, meltdown, energy depletion, and environmental devastation, not allowing us to continue with unlimited growth. Unlimited growth is part of what has been destroying us and the Earth community. So I don't want to go back to that model. I want to be part of finding a new model that is based on sustainability and based on connection with the Earth community.
Stay tuned. Radio EcoShock will be back in 1 minute with more from Carolyn Baker.